Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to a brand new edition of Freedom Books, Flowers and the Moon, the podcast brought to you each week by the Times Literary Supplement. My name is Stig Abel, the editor of the TLS. So, put on some gaudy jumpers, sit morosely with a paper crown slipping off your sweaty head, and reconsider where your life is going. Yes, it's Christmas. I'm here with the always festive Thea Lenarduzzi. Thea, buon Natale, is that right?
Yeah, it is.
Auguri. Unless Google has lied to me.
It has not lied.
What did you say?
It's reliable. Auguri.
What does that mean?
Good wishes.
Auguri.
Auguri.
Auguri. Yeah, it's lovely. We're here also with some other TLS Christmas elves, indie rock star, Lucy Dallas.
Hello, in English. Hello.
Hello. The doctor and refugee from the 18th century, Michael Caines.
Hello. Thank you for letting me back in the studio yet again.
And Minister of Fun, Ros Dineen.
Hi.
And I also learnt you are also a rock star, just seconds ago.
We all are, in a very real sense.
In a very sarcastic sense, you all are. But in the actual sense, you sang on an album.
Sort of, yeah. Can we not talk about it, please?
Okay. That only adds to the mystery, which now for the next 50 times that you're on this podcast, we'll be able to explore that. You look keen about that. So we're going to do two things today. We're going to talk about our favourite arts of the year, and we're also going to do something we do on this show anyway, all of the time, particularly at the beginning. We're going to talk about food.
Yes.
Your expertise.
Yes.
One of your areas. It sounds like that sounds mean, doesn't it? One of your areas of expertise. We're going to talk about Christmas dinners.
Yes.
Are we a bit?
Yeah, a bit.
And our favourite food in literature?
Yes, more of that.
And oysters?
Yep.
And other things?
And other things.
Okay, let's
all
do
sorts.
That. Okay, arts first then. Two arts of the year. A relatively new tradition in the paper is to ask a bunch of experts, even though we do not, as a nation, believe in them anymore, for their picks of 2018's best films, exhibitions, plays, operas, ballets and the like. Lucy, you're the doyenne, it says here. The
if
arts
you
pages.
Say so, it says here on my script, you're the doyenne.
Yeah.
Yep, indeed I am, Stig.
You've had some people make recommendations.
You say this.
Yeah, they haven't all filed yet, have they? If we're brutally honest with the situation, we're recording this just before the paper's ready.
Live arts journalism being the exciting medium that it is.
Up to the minute.
Mm-hmm. If I said that everybody had filed, I wouldn't be telling you the truth.
No.
So, some people, not
in
so,
some
a few people... Have, I'm trying not to do a number.
Yeah. Of those who have filed, Lucy, what has interested you the most?
Lucy, how many people have filed?
One person.
More
I mean,
than
I can
one.
Get down to nitty gritty, Ros, because no. I'm looking forward to your piece.
Yeah. Is Ros in it?
Yeah,
Ros
I didn't
is
know
it.
That. Ros hasn't filed
oh,
yet.
Oh, for God's sake.
I honestly
we
didn't
did
know.
Know. Let's take this offline.
Ros, yeah. Ros is going to file on this podcast now,
yes.
Effectively.
Well, kind of, yeah. Somebody recommended Tate Britain's All Too Human exhibition.
Was that
which
the only
was,
person
no, not the only person.
Which one was that? Remind me
which,
of that.
So we reviewed, Susan Owens reviewed it for Ros. It was like a sort of 100 years of figurative painting, British, no, not just British, I don't think, actually. It was at the Tate.
Yeah.
It was 100 years of figurative painting, so there was a lot of Francis Bacon and Lucian Freud, but not just them, all sorts of people. Everyone said the Paul Arago was wonderful, and lots of stuff was brilliant. And
people like figurative painting.
Yes, that's the shock revelation
that's
of 2018.
Classic, is that a classic mark? The take that's just the bums on seats type approach to.
Well, it had a lot of big names in it, and I think some people thought it was a bit loose because it was called, what was it called? All Too Human, something to do with life. You can tell I've done my research. I have done research, but not in this area.
Okay.
Some people felt it was a bit baggy. It was just some paintings from
or
the past
figures.
100 years. Well, and one of them was of a dog. I mean, that's a figure, but I thought it was just human, but they weren't only human. But I think the quality of what they got was so good, i.e. there were so many Lucian Freuds.
Are people still interested in Lucian Freud? That feels a bit 90s.
I think they are. And Francis Bacon and Paul Arago and Coldstream, is it? Who was very much a different sort of thing. And Paolozzi.
There was a lot.
I'm looking at Michael.
He's entirely the wrong century for him.
That's true. It's
I
much
don't
too late
that
for
any
Michael.
Of these people have been born yet.
And on the Lucian Freud point, I think there's a huge retrospective coming next year. So clearly he's...
So he's obviously really bankable.
Yeah.
But he became big again. Did he? In my mind, I associate him before the YBAs, you know, that whole sort of 90s movement. He became big again in the 90s, but maybe that's just when I heard of him.
But I think then from that point, he became a kind of, you know, granddaddy of the scene.
Yeah.
I think. I mean, I'm not sure he's ever gone out of fashion, really.
Go on, give us some more.
When you say some, so I talked to... No,
thank
I talked,
God we've got some here.
I talked to our TV correspondent because he's in the office.
Andrew
and
Lillian.
I made him talk to me. He's going to talk about Inside Number 9.
Ah, this What's is that? The League of Gentlemen thing.
Yeah, yeah, where they have a separate...
Very clever.
...sort of play every week,
It's like
less,
a genuine... And they've done it live as well.
Yeah, there
TV.
Was the Halloween special that was live. That was very clever.
Mm.
And apparently they did one of Shakespeare, they did a Macbeth thing.
Yeah, I mean they riff on loads of things. It's very meta.
Is it enjoyable?
It is. I think it's a little bit hit and miss, although mostly hit. Very much mostly hit.
Do you have to like The League of Gentlemen to like it?
No, it's very
it's a bit
very
horror-y,
different actually.
Isn't
yeah,
it?
It's still
I mean,
got
it's
that kind
horror-y.
Of horror yeah. undertone.
The League of Gentlemen, I feel it's one of those things that you respect but don't like.
I love The League of
Do
Gentlemen.
You?
See, some of The League of Gentlemen is wonderful.
I just look at it and think, it's
brilliant,
it's clever and it's weird.
Yeah.
But it doesn't make me... But
so when you say, is it enjoyable, it's with that doubt about League of Gentlemen in mind. You
yeah, exactly.
It's not possible. It's too clever to
it's
be...
Clever, it's
funny.
Clever and, I'm sure, beautifully written. But is it
But some of it is funny. There's that vet that, like, kills all the animals. That's funny. No? Thea thinks it's funny.
Both from the north, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah.
Both from the north.
Oh,
yeah,
we love a bit of that.
It's clearly,
no,
yeah.
No, but it is, some of it is really funny.
The other thing is interesting, this doing shows live.
Because
I interviewed Lee Mack for Front Row, and they're doing Not Going Out, the sitcom, and at Christmas they're doing it live.
Oh, they like they now do with Mrs. Brown's Boys.
So they just do
well,
it
sort of
a series once a year, and I was watching them rehearse.
Yeah.
And it's a sitcom... And it was quite a complicated setup they were doing, and they just make themselves do it as a play, live on telly.
Didn't they do that with Friends?
They've done it with EastEnders. They've never done it. That's not
no,
American.
They've done it with one comedy, or did they do it with Big Bang Theory or something? There's one of those big
Have
ones they?
They
did it with
it's
once.
It's kind of
and
a throwback to the way all TV was.
Yeah,
there used to,
yeah.
There was, you know, a long time ago, decades ago, there was no point in reviewing the TV because you'd never see it. So people barely ever wrote about what was on last night. There's no way you'd catch it.
Mm.
And there've been various, you know, throwbacks. There was a version of the Quatermass Experiment. Was that maybe 10 years ago? David Tennant and a few other people were in it fluffing their lines. And it was the joy of seeing them trying
yes,
to do it live.
Yes,
and EastEnders, do you remember in EastEnders?
They
the actress
did one
called,
live one.
They did a live one and I they remember. Called it... I think one of the actresses said to Ian Beale's character, she said, oh yeah, what do you think, Ian? And she called... the character by the name
yeah.
of the actor.
And they didn't, none of the actors knew which of the three endings they recorded was going to be the one until they'd practiced until
they did it live.
Until it was live.
Oh
so they
my
didn't,
God.
Yeah.
Is this gimmicky? Because I was trying to, is it a gimmick or is it fun, do you think? You get a bit of the jeopardy of the theatre, don't you? That's presumably the point.
I think that's the idea, a bit of edge to it. Yeah.
And there's also that thing of, I think it's probably very rare these days to have a viewing experience where you know that, you know, a huge chunk of the population is sitting down to watch this thing at the same time as you, and you're united in that viewing experience.
Yeah, which still happens at Christmas. I mean, not to me anymore. I don't watch Christmas TV anymore. When I was a kid, you were so excited about the only time you see a film, I seem to remember. I don't know if this is just I'm slightly glossing
How old
over.
Are you, Steve?
38.
65.
Yeah. Do you remember this, Michael? You know,
go on.
They'd be like the big Christmas film.
Yeah,
they'd be
and
like,
everyone would sit down and watch it together.
And you couldn't get it anywhere else. So,
yeah.
And it would be... It had been in the cinema probably in February of the year before.
And it would be a really big one, like E.T. or something.
Yeah. But did that still happen? I'm sure it does. Probably.
Well, they still show a lot of
but
films.
No one, but
Doctor
still...
Who tends to be a bit of an event like that, I think, doesn't it?
Well, that well, this year has been moved from Christmas Day to New Year.
Has it?
And there will be no new season in 2019.
Why?
They will do one, but they're holding it till 2020.
Okay.
That's the latest.
So with your arts of the year, Michael, before we get to... I don't know if you're going to recommend... Would you have recommended Doctor Who as one of your arts of the year?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's been controversial. There are a lot of people who reacted weirdly to the idea that the Doctor, an alien with two hearts who has lived for hundreds of years, could be a woman, which doesn't really seem that... Yeah, it's not realistic, is it? Let's face it. A lot of people reacted strangely to that, but yeah. I think there's a deeper lying problem with the show in that it had become very strange and convoluted. You could only really follow it if you're an avid fan taking notes and watching out for odd continuity things from 5 years back. It was completely ridiculous, and they'd messed up all the central relationships. And I really like this new one. It's a breath of fresh air, I think.
Jodie Whittaker's
She's great.
So you've met her. Yeah, I interviewed her, and I said she was Doctor Who.
Yeah,
you got it wrong. Yeah.
Doctor Who. Who's counting?
People count. Apparently
John Smith,
count.
Occasionally, the character was called counting. On Earth.
Yeah. So. According to my correspondence, people do count on that sort of thing.
But as it happened, one of the writers of an episode in this new season, Joy Wilkinson, wrote, I think, the best play I saw on the London... maybe on the London stage, but certainly on the London Fringe this year, which was called The Sweet Science of Bruising, and it was just down the road at the Southwark Playhouse. It was a slightly improbable situation, four very different women come together in the middle of the 19th century and discover boxing and sort of beat one another up. But it's very well done. It was really energetic, real sort of shock,
cool.
Very up close. And I think she's a sort of writer to watch, really.
Is it too right on? Because I only see bits of the sort of response, but there was an allegation, and it may just be sort of relatively right-wing people on Twitter make this accusation, but it's so obsessed with identity politics that mm-hmm. almost the stories become a vehicle to talk about Rosa Parks. It was a story about Rosa Parks,
that's right,
wasn't
yeah.
there? So talking about gender inequality or racial inequality, is there any truth to that as an argument, do you think?
Well, there may be something in it that people don't like on that score, but that's always been an element of the programme.
Has it really?
It was educational from the very beginning. The first story was in 1963, was not the Daleks. It was called An Unearthly Child, and they end up going back to a kind of caveman setting. Very vague, but weird. But then the stories were about the French Revolution, or they might be set in sort of Merry England or something. So they might not be completely serious history lessons, but that was always there. And of course, it's always about good fighting evil. I don't really see that there's too much of a problem with that. And actually, you could take... Because they've gone for very discrete stories this time round, rather than one story arc that you have to follow closely from one episode to another, you can take a selection of those episodes, and I don't think you'd find anything in it that was a sign of political correctness gone mad. The last one had absolutely no sign at all of some kind of history lesson or lecture or sermon about it. I think people are picking and choosing what they want
from
in that respect.
Right.
I'm sure there's been some terrible episodes, but on the whole, I think it's been quite a success.
Good season. Right, who wants to offer another Art of the Year? Roz, do you want to? Is this going to appear in your Arts of the Year? You set to file to Lucy, or do you want to do different ones?
Let's do live filing right now.
So I do different ones.
I'll
transcribe.
Yeah.
My Arts of the Year were... Well, I'm going to do for you, Lucy, for your page, I'm going to do audio.
Splendid.
Aren't I?
Yep.
So one of my audio of the year was an episode of This American Life called Five Women. Stop me if I've told you about this before. Have I told you about this one before?
I thought that was the title.
Stop me if I've told you before. It's a good name. That's actually a good name for a podcast, isn't it?
Yeah. Isn't it, though?
Yeah, yeah.
That's a really good name. So Five Women starts with this psychologist, Vivian, being interviewed about her experiences of sort of sexual harassment throughout her life. And then they start talking about her husband, who was kind of the editor of this progressive news site. And she always knew he was a flirt. And then these sexual harassment allegations start coming out against him. And
this is a true story.
True story. And the reporter then interviews and follows Vivian plus four of the women who brought out harassment allegations against Don, not just through their experiences with Don and what happens next, but also the reporter understands there's no sort of Me Too movement that is separate from the rest of everyone's lives. It's not like there's one moment where it's like something happened. Every single harassment allegation or just general thing that women put up with is part of a big story.
It's a steady drip rather than a...
Yeah. Mm. So she puts everything in its context, and it's subtle and it's nuanced and it's not bashing. Like, Don is treated in this very sort of human way. It's the most intelligent passing of Me Too that I've encountered.
Where are we in American Life? Because I feel like I've been hearing about it forever, and I've heard some episodes. Are we on, like, does it do seasons? Are we well in the...
Oh, no, it's just once a week. We're into, like, the 700th episode.
Every week?
Yeah.
Sometimes they repeat them.
Yeah. Is it consistently good?
No, there are some that stand out. It's a lovely thing to listen to every week, and there are some that stand out.
And that one was the...
And then, do you want the rest of my... Oh, yeah.
Why not?
So we keep going. I'm going to recommend one thing that I haven't actually seen.
Nice.
But it's definitely my
Oscar. You review it for me, but don't go and see it.
There's a film called Roma coming out.
Oh, yeah. Or just come out.
It's in this
week. We all know
And
about
it's in this week.
Yeah.
Lucy's
actually read this article because it's in her on her page.
Everyone's going crazy about
it. Is it Adam Mars Jones's?
Yes,
it is. Yeah. Everyone says it's wonderful.
Everyone says it's wonderful.
Is this Cuarón?
Yes, Alfonso Cuarón, and it's a semi-autobiographical take of his...
What's the basis for you making this one of your arts of the year?
Honestly, it's so... I love everything he's done, and it's so rarely that you encounter something that someone you love has done, and just the praise around it.
It could be wrong.
It could be wrong, but I don't think it is. Okay, well, I'll come back in the new year.
This is an event, though, for Netflix, isn't it, to be... doing this, putting it out to cinemas and being able to make it
on Netflix as well. And I think it's on Netflix probably by the time this comes out.
But they've started doing that because it's the only way they can get Academy Award nominations. Yeah. They have to do the deal, don't they?
Right.
So it's minimal. They do minimal screenings in order to qualify for Academy Award nominations. And then they push it out on Netflix.
That's what we should do when we release our film.
Tell me about that film.
We can workshop it in a bit.
Okay.
I'm just saying that's what we should do.
After you've filed Arts of the Year workshop.
My other film of the year is Tully, which I have actually seen.
Well done.
Yes.
It's an excellent film.
What is Tully about?
It's a film. It's actually a film about postnatal depression, Stig. But
you remember it from Roz's excellent piece on it in the Times of True
Supplement. Oh, yes.
But what it is it's a witty... beautifully shot,
You were really high on this.
About a really important issue that you don't see reflected back to you in your culture. You see it in your life, you do not see it on the screen, you don't encounter it. It's brilliant. So that was definitely one of my films of the year. So I could keep going.
We'll post some editorial constraints. Do one more.
Jesmyn Ward.
That's a book.
Yeah, aren't we doing arts?
No.
Well,
I mean, yes.
You've done books of the year. You've got to have a system.
It's the TLS. There's no books.
Chaos.
All right, stop.
Okay, who wants to chime in? I got the feeling, Ross, you've not paid an awful lot. You haven't been well, have you?
Do you know what? I only saw that bit that we need to bring the thing about food examples. Yeah. Saw that like 10 minutes ago.
Well, okay. You pause for a second and think of your food examples.
I have.
I feel like Monica from Friends trying to do forced fun here. Do you know? There's a kind of... It's like when she has
Nobody
a party
was going to say it.
And everyone has to fill out their top jobs or whatever. Thea, you look like you're... Give us an Arts of the Year that you have seen and isn't art.
I can do exhibitions. So I can do Dorothea Lang and Vanessa Winship. That was at the Barbican.
Okay.
Sort of documentary photography. So you end up with the founder, one of the founders, Dorothea Lang, and then Vanessa Winship, who is still working. And so, you know, going through both of those exhibitions, one is on the ground floor and Vanessa Winship's upstairs, you kind of move from... the Dust Bowl photographs, Migrant Mother being Dorothea Lang's most famous, and then upstairs you've got Winship and she sort of works her way through the Rust Belt and the Balkans, and she's looking at identity and memory. That was great to see them both together, and also to see loads of Dorothea Lang work that I'd never seen before, because obviously everyone's familiar with the Dust Bowl stuff and Migrant Mother and all of those photographs, but I'd never seen her photographs of the American internment of the Japanese after Pearl Harbor, obviously. And
we had a piece on that by Jeremy Treglone, didn't we?
Yes, exactly.
Who did the photographs for that? Someone did a book on the internment.
I don't remember. Yeah. But the
Lucy, you didn't read the paper. Don't you just look confused.
We did review that exhibition, though. So if you'd like me to...
Who reviewed that?
If you'd like me to reveal that I did read that piece, I can.
Who reviewed that?
What, the Dorothea Lange?
Yeah.
Judith Flanders did it for us, and she thought it was terrific.
Yeah, and just so great to see it all together. And films, I'm going to give you Phantom Thread, which I was pleased was actually, I saw in February this year, that was a UK release date. I was worried I was going to have to think of something else, but Phantom Thread.
Adam Mars Jones did not like that?
He
snooted on it, didn't he?
I had a lot to say about Adam Mars Jones's piece, but I said it to myself.
Oh, say it to
said
Lucy.
It quietly
right
to myself. Lucy didn't do it. I disagreed with him. I think some of the points that he made were over Daniel Day-Lewis's character having an affected accent, and he thought that was accidental, but I think it was kind of integral to his character, as he's this very poised dressmaker. And it's just a beautiful film. It's Paul Thomas Anderson, whose films I always love.
Ansel Adams did the internment photographs.
Ah, yes.
That's what I was thinking of. Sorry.
Okay. And so that was an amazing film. Johnny Greenwood did the soundtrack, which was just luscious.
Of Radiohead fame.
Yes. What else? What other? I liked Pavel Pavlikovsky's film, Cold War.
Also reviewed by Adam Mars-Jones.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Also black and white, like Roma.
Yeah, and I admired it. Very, very strong aesthetic. It was very, very stylish. The opening kind of idea is that there are these people going through Poland in the 1949 or early 1950s, and they're looking for authentic folk musicians and performers. And then you kind of have that playing out, and they want to found a school that preserves and forwards that kind of art, and then it gets co-opted by Stalin. That's kind of in parallel to this couple who are completely two, a man and a woman. He's older, she's younger, they're completely different. She's religious, he's not, and how they're trying to figure out their own love story, and it sort of plays with melodrama and all of these conventions.
It's no Johnny English 3 by the sounds of it.
No, I mean, tell us about that, Justin.
Is that your film of the year?
No, I did have to watch it, and it was really as bad as one might imagine it would be. Michael, do you want to throw any more out?
Oh, well, I'll only chip in two more things that come to mind because they're a contradiction. I got to see Mark Rylance as Iago this year at Shakespeare's Globe, and it was terrific. It was directed by Claire Van Kampen with Andre Holland as Othello, which I got
did an excellent review for the Times of Truth.
Got to review, but then as well as
picking up my own pages,
everything
your own pages
so
are fantastic.
Together.
They've taken a lot of flack, and they're really good pages. Yeah. And I have a pay
thank you, Michael. Yeah.
Many criticise the arts pages, but not you,
not me,
but not to my
loyal
face.
Loyal to the last, at least for now. But the thing that I would contrast with that is that I got to see the episode of Upstart Crow, where they take the piss out of Mark Rylance and
yes.
his incredibly stagey, ridiculous acting, where the actor Wolf Hall comes on and is terribly serious with long pauses. And so I've got to have Rylance, the real Rylance, who was fantastic and had everybody in the palm of his hand. Great, great performance. And I really appreciate them taking the mick out of him.
They've got to take the mick out of him because he doesn't believe Shakespeare wrote the plays of Shakespeare.
That's the ridiculous thing about him, and always has
who
been.
Who does he think wrote them?
Who's he?
Off the top of my head, I can't remember. I think he hangs around a kind of De Vere-ish view, but he's more interested in the agnostic, sceptical kind of line.
The De Vere-ish view, which I only recently realised, is the view that De Vere died in 1605.
That's
right.
Yes. Yeah, so
and so the theory to people who believe Shakespeare didn't write Shakespeare because he was too common, basically, is I must have been an aristocrat. Oh, it's De Vere. De Vere died in 1605, and therefore all the plays that were produced between 1606 and 1613, which is quite a considerable.
There's quite a few good plays there, which they've been hiding.
He just kept in a cupboard,
and someone
found. I think Occam's Razor would suggest that's not that likely, isn't it?
It does seem unlikely, but not to people like Mark Rylance. I mean, who knows, maybe they're onto something, which is another reason why he had the piss taken out of him in Upstart Crow. So I rather enjoyed that.
Is Upstart, what do you think of Upstart Crow?
I love it.
It's Ben Elton wrote a sitcom about Shakespeare's life.
Yes.
And you like it?
I do like it. So it's up to the end of the third season. There will be a Christmas special of that, so you can have the tradition of
are
gathering
you
around.
Commission? Yeah.
Absolutely. I'm selling all of this. There's some stuff I really hate, but they're not paying me enough to. So. And they're,
at least
it's interesting because they've done, I mean, obviously Ben Elton's known for working on Blackadder, and they've got up to a point now where one of Shakespeare's has died.
He can do no wrong.
So it's a complete farce, for most of it. It's the last episode, and then it takes a little serious turn.
Mm. Which, of course, he did in Blackadder.
Oh, she didn't back out, exactly.
It's Hamlet. It's Hamlet.
Hamlet.
Yeah.
Who died. I suppose it seems fitting because, don't they always say about if Shakespeare were alive, he would have been writing sitcoms? So.
Yeah, I never quite buy that.
I don't think. Yeah, it's too convenient, isn't it? We would be writing for EastEnders, or he'd be struggling. He's
or
struggling
he'd be Tarantino.
Artists. People just.
Oh, is it EastEnders?
Yes, EastEnders. Yeah. But my theory of Shakespeare, the reason why I think Shakespeare is so profoundly magnificent, is no one in history combines being a hack, having to churn stuff out, and being a genius. You're normally
Mozart.
And that's a good example of another one then. But
there's
not many who actually have to produce and hack it out, and therefore the channel for your genius is so large, it just overflows, it's constant pouring out. And most people, if you're a genius, once you do something of genius, you then sit somewhere rarefied and gradually...
And nobody questions you
and you're just
again,
left at it. Whereas Shakespeare basically every day had to get up and for 20 years... put out another play, and therefore you get those two tremendous flowerings, the Hamlet, what is it, the 1599 one, and then the 1606 one, which is when De Vere are dead, where you just get just a run of, was it Julius Caesar, Hamlet, As You Like It,
Twelfth Night, in
a row, which is just, when you think about it, no one has ever done anything as good as that ever in all of art, arguably.
you could cut it. I mean, if he died in the plague in the 1590s, you'd still have something absolutely remarkable. You wouldn't have, you know, Lear and a lot of other things, but you'd have some pretty remarkable things that move the whole idea of drama on stage forward and characterization forward. What Upstart Crow does, I suppose, is take all of this material and make the silliest possible response out of it. David Mitchell plays Shakespeare as a man who's constantly stealing ideas, books that are left on the privy. There's the woman in the house who isn't allowed to act, of course, completely frustrated, completely desperate to go on stage, and she never can. Marlowe's just hanging around being a bit of a lad. It's absolutely ludicrous. Awesome. And I quite like that. It's quite silly. I've given up on all the other responses, which are all too grand and just silly.
Yeah. Anyone else for any more? I've got a couple. Lucy, why don't you, as arts doyen? How would you say doyen? Doyen?
Doyen. I would say doyen.
Doyen, yeah. I think I got it wrong first time. Yeah. Well, not unusually for me. Go on.
I've got a couple of things. One of them is an artist of the year. I mean, I'm not really supposed to do this, but I was just thinking about it.
You can do anything you like. Roz has already shattered
the
rules of engagement by doing stuff about books, Roz, and stuff she hasn't seen.
Tore down the rules.
Yeah.
I would just like to say, and this is not in any way original, I would say Simon Russell Beale for Artist of the Year, because I've seen him in Death of Stalin. I saw him Mr. Sedley in Vanity Fair. I saw him for about 10 minutes, and it was just absolutely brilliant what he did. And I saw him on stage.
Everyone hated
Lehman
Vanity Fair, didn't they?
But I really did just turn it on. I saw a bit of it and didn't much like it. And then I turned it on one time, and he was on. So you watch because he was on. And he did a bit where he's ruined Mr. Sedley by the collapse of the sort of stock market, isn't he?
Yeah.
And he just... And Russell Beale kind of crumpled, not at all in a stagey way. He just kind of collapses and falls apart. And you thought, oh, my God, you know, what's going on? And he was just wonderful. And I saw him in the Lehman trilogy.
Which is long.
Which is very, very long.
And you enjoyed it.
I mean, they were all wondrous, but he was really wondrous. And he really did have everyone... You know, it doesn't happen very often. It's like Michael saying that Mark Rylance can do it as well. Sometimes there's one person, and they're not. It's not that they're upstaging everybody else, but that they're just doing it out of their skin. And the whole theatre will watch them, whatever they're doing. It doesn't. I've seen it about two or three times, yeah. I'd say. Mark Rylance was one of them. The other one was Marcello Magni from Complicité, who was just amazing.
Yeah.
And I think Simon Russell Beale did that as well. If he'd said to the whole audience... I don't know, you know, look in your pockets and give me a tenner. I mean, everybody would have done it. You'd have done whatever he asked.
I don't have a tenner.
No, Michael, look into your pockets.
Does he take card?
Yeah. That's a power that could be abused when you think about it.
So he would, that would be the person. Because I've seen him in different sort of doing different
that's
things
good.
And he was amazing. And in terms of a live thing.
Yes, not a book.
Not a book. It's not a book. And I was there.
Yeah.
I went to a prom.
Ooh.
I know, music. I went to Tarangalila by Messiaen, and I went with Adrian of the TLS. I go to all of my arts events with a member of the TLS, and this time it was Adrian. Tarangalila, it's Sanskrit. It's Sanskrit, obviously.
Did everyone else, when Lucy said that, did everyone sort of go, oh, Tarangalila?
I was just thinking it's such a lovely sounding title.
It is. It's not a well-known thing.
So none of us here had heard of that?
Oh, no. Michael has. No. Michael has. Michael
had
probably whistle it.
Did you?
Oh, it's so beautiful.
Oh, Michael, you're so...
Go on, ask me about the quartet at the end of time. Ask me about that.
That's good, isn't it?
Anyway, it was on...
Who's it by again?
It's by Messiaen.
Messiaen.
Who was... Obsessed by three things. I was reading about him because he taught Pierre Boulez. He taught everybody. He was very much into church. He was obsessed by three things, which was basically the church. He was very, very, very believy, you know. Do you know why I said that? Because I was going to say, this is going to sound awful, I was going to say croyant because that's what he said.
Oh,
I know,
for God's sake.
Oh, an intro.
There was a pitch of expertise there, wasn't there? There are three things that we know about this person.
I prefer believy.
So he was
translating from croyant.
And then he's famous for trying to transcribe bird song.
Oh, so lovely. He
tried to transcribe it and reproduce it in music, which arguably, some people said it drove him bananas. What do you think, Michael? I mean,
I'd like to think so.
I mean, it's very, very difficult to do, we say.
Pointless,
and he was just doing
it
in a field. He didn't have, like, equipment and stuff. He'd be in a field listening in a hedge with his pencil.
That thrush is singing in C type.
Yeah, but and then he would write down what the thrush was singing. And then also the organ was his other obsession. And there's a brilliant... I was just reading about a thing about Boulez snorting about him because he was taught by Messiaen, and Boulez was just saying all of those things were awful and that he thought that the work that he did around the time of Tarangalila was brothel music and vomit. and go, no, hang on, Boulez, tell us what you really think. And actually, when it came out, Triangle, it's a ridiculous, large sort of symphony in about 10 or 12.
Why it's very rarely done, because it needs an organ, doesn't it?
It needs a huge orchestra, 8 to 11 percussionists. There was loads of keyboard instruments, not all of which I could identify. You need a pianist of extraordinary technique and virtuosity, and you need an onde martino, which... Well, it sounds like a theremin,
good question, Roz,
which is the thing that you hear in science fiction, like that. Yeah. So an onde martino is like a theremin. It was made at the same time. And it's this bonkers piece, which is supposed to be about love and the garden of love and Sanskrit ideas about something, which...
A bit believy for my taste.
Well, it's not very believy, actually. No. It's mad. There isn't any of that in it.
Not believy enough for my taste.
And it's got these amazing kind of... wonderful swoony tunes with the onde martino going woo and the strings all over the place, and it's very chromatic, and then sometimes just a load of percussion will kind of barrel its way through the middle of it.
Give us the title one more time for people taking notes.
Tarangalila. Yeah, a lot of people think it's awful. I think it's wonderful.
I love it. Up there with Vaughan Williams 5, Sibelius 2.
Stop it.
So I think it was charming about 5 minutes ago. We've overdone it.
A bit too believy for me.
Yeah,
well done, Lucy.
Too believy. Well done, Lucy. Well, I was going to say something, but I think we've probably run out of time. I would say
Go on, tell us yours.
Lee Miller at the Hepworth Wakefield, I went to see.
What, her photos?
Yeah, her photos are part of the British Surrealism, which I don't really like the British Surrealism stuff, but the Lee Miller photos, the famous picture of her in Hitler's bath.
Mm.
It's just brilliant. In fact, she was Vogue's war correspondent and was sent into... I mean, she was there for 2 years and was photographing concentration camps. It was amazing stuff. And then she gets to Hitler's apartment and she takes pictures of it, and then there's a bath and she just gets in it.
And she walks in with her boots, and the boots covered in Auschwitz mud.
Yeah, and the boots are left next to the bath and she gets in. And when you see that picture, it's just... this wonderful thing. I hadn't really heard of her, but didn't quite know where she fitted into the British Surrealism. Isn't very good, it seems to me.
You should go to her house in Sussex.
Where she was,
Farley's with Roland Penrose.
Roland Penrose.
It's amazing. Yeah. It's such a wonderful artist's house to visit.
And that's where she used to hang out with all these surrealists.
Picasso.
And Henry Moore used to go there, and they used to sort of mess around together. It's worth it.
Yeah, it's really good. And you can see her kitchen where she cooked the most amazing meals. And there's a tile that Picasso did that's just sort of sitting above the Arga.
I've got one of them.
Yeah. Always comes back to food. In fact, that is a segue.
There you are.
Thea.
You've not finished yet.
No, I've had enough. You don't hear me rambling on about things that I've liked.
I want to go about Johnny
England.
Johnny's three. Yeah, it's terrible, as you might imagine. I mean, as bad as you think it is. You know, Rowan Atkinson, you know, as we're talking about Ben Elton, who, because he did Blackadder, can do no wrong as far as I'm concerned. Brilliant man. Loved his novels when I was a kid. Loved Blackadder. But Rowan Atkinson... You know, I love Blackadder more than anyone, and yet I think he's done such bad work since then that I think I'm actually not prepared to forgive him for it, even with Blackadder.
Fair enough.
Who likes Mr. Bean apart from
almost everyone in the world?
In France, it's a big deal, isn't it?
Yeah, China. Everyone except for you likes Mr. Bean.
I don't like Mr. Bean.
Does anyone in this room like Mr. Bean?
No.
I don't hate Mr. Bean.
No, of course, doesn't like Mr. Bean.
Do you like Mr. Bean, Michael?
I virtually am Mr. Bean.
Can I say that's not true?
No, he's hairier than Mr. Bean.
Oh, yes.
Oh, no, but
he's a hairy.
Very.
Yeah. In a minute, let's talk about some food.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
I am pleased to say that we do have a food and drink issue, or spread of pieces, in this week's paper.
Yes.
I'm pleased to get to it now because you shall see before you here.
Although people listening will not see before.
I'm about to describe what you guys can see, but they cannot.
Go on.
Nor can they smell it, sadly.
I can't smell it.
Some Italian cake.
You brought some Varese. Italian cake? What is it called?
It's called Dolce Varese, and it's an example of how inventive and entrepreneurial Italians can be, because it was only invented in the 1930s when this patissier in Varese realised that so many other places in Italy have their own traditional cake and Varese does not.
Oh.
So Dolce Varese was born, and it's kind of a bit like Madeira cake, I think, except that it has a mix of corn flour and normal flour, so it's better for you than normal cake, basically.
Did you make this?
No, I didn't. I bought it.
So what is it? Is it a pistachio cake?
Well, the pistachio is, as I was saying to Lucy earlier, is an adult spin on it. Normally it's plain with just some icing sugar. But I saw this pistachio version and I thought, I'm an adult now, so
it's
I can
make pistachio. It's nice, but it's not...
No, it's very simple. The whole point is that it's a day cake. So you have it for breakfast.
A day cake.
You know, it's not an occasion thing. It's not an occasion
thing. It's an adult cake, apparently.
Oh,
it's a breakfast cake.
It's a breakfast cake.
I think breakfast cakes are much underrated.
Breakfast cakes are
wonderful.
Oh, my gosh,
it's delicious.
What do you think, Michael?
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's really good.
It's quite dry.
Is it meant to be like that?
We should have brought champagne in to wash it down.
Yeah.
It's a day cake. You have champagne.
What do you think, Lucy?
Don't you have champagne every day?
I like it.
You like it, Michael?
Mm-hmm.
You can't do a thumbs up on a podcast, Michael.
Michael just did the thumbs up sign.
Thumbs up. Anyway, there is a point to this.
Go on.
The point to this is, I mean, apart from just having cake,
yeah.
Who needs a point? That the selection of pieces that we have in this food and drink spread are, they're sort of a quiet tribute to Britain and Europe. So we have a piece, we have Italian cake here, we have Ian Sansom writing a deconstruction, giving us a deconstruction of the British Christmas dinner, which is as fun as it sounds. And then we have Tim Crane trotting us through wine snobbery. His tale begins in May 1976, and it's known as the Judgment of Paris, and it was this blind tasting when Californian wines were pitted against French wines, and the Californian wines wiped the floor with the French wines. And so then he kind of uses that to look at wine snobbery more broadly in wine.
I have to say, I always buy, because my wife loves red wine, I always buy New World wine, red wine, because it's always for them, you get much better value for the money. So if you buy like a 15 quid Australian wine, it's much better than if you buy a 15 quid French wine, because French prices are still inflated. So a 15 quid Australian wine tastes better than a 15 quid French wine, because France is it. And so if you ever want to buy someone who, like, this is my experience, and I could be dubbed a total philistine, but it's a good way of getting better value for your buck.
I mean, we should call Tim Crane, get him on the line.
So he'll tell me I'm wrong.
Probably.
I'll email him afterwards. I'll email him afterwards, and if I'm wrong, I'll admit it at a later podcast. I'll just read out his censure.
Okay, but leave the New World to one side, because we're still in Europe.
Oh, sorry, I forgot this was a crypto pro-EU moment. Get on with leaving here.
Then we can get on with eating. So we have Paul Levy, and he's looking at this book that has just been translated from the original French, which came out, I think, last year. And it's a book by François-Régis Gaudry and his friends, he says, and friends. And it's called Let's Eat France! Exclamation mark. And he kind of trots through the whole of the country, and he has these poster-sized guides. And they're guides to the varieties of vanilla, pasta, chickpeas, cherries,
it's like cassons, an impossibly large subject,
edible
isn't
seaweeds,
it?
Garlic, sausages, omelettes, testicles, all sorts. I mean... Anyway, they're poster-sized guides, so you can peruse them at your will. He also has a nice little foray into food slang, based around the onion, which you commented on, Stig.
Oh, because it's there's a phrase. Lucy, you know how interested I am in French idiom.
You're very interested in
What's
French
What's the one
idiom?
That I really liked about pavements? Can you remember that?
Pavements?
Paving slabs.
I thought it was about, la dalle, j'ai la dalle.
What is
when you say la dalle the whole time. I had a friend who just used to say...
What does it mean?
Well, if you say, have you got any... Like, if I said, have you got any food, and you said que dalle, it would mean I haven't got anything. I've only got paving stones. And also he would say j'ai la dalle, which, like, I've got the paving stone. I don't know why he said this. He might be the only person in the world who did. But it meant I'm really hungry.
I love a foreign, like, there's a Spanish, this is completely different, but there's a Spanish phrase which, when someone brags a lot, in Spanish you say, he doesn't need a grandmother.
Oh, that's so nice.
Because they puff themselves up. And I love it. Because you could never invent that idiom. It must just arise naturally. And the onion one is get dressed.
Oh, the onion one. Well, there's all sorts, really. There's aux petits oignons, which means to be cajoled or pampered. Then there's, the one that you liked, être vêtu comme un oignon, which is to wear several layers of clothing. Oh, it's like the onion approach.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, get dressed like an onion.
There's also occupe-toi de tes oignons, which is basically mind your own business. This doesn't
mind your own onions.
Yeah, mind your own onions.
Is that a sort of testicle reference, do you think?
Not necessarily.
No, it's an onion reference.
No, it's just look after your onions and I'll look after mine. I got a
testicle vibe.
Blimey.
I don't know. It's French, isn't it?
Must be testicles involved.
There must be somewhere.
And from there we jump to Maren Meinhardt, our German editor, who's written a beautiful piece on German food, in which she takes two books that have come out at the same time and take incredibly different approaches to German food. One of them harks back to this kind of imagined past where everything is stodge and pork and...
That's lovely.
And it's all bound by paintings, brought together by paintings by Caspar David Friedrich, who Maren points out, he's best known for a period, the Romantic period, which was synonymous with premature death rather than hearty eating.
Oh, maybe the two are connected.
Interesting. And then she contrasts that with a book by Anja Donk, who takes a fresh and thoughtful look at German food.
See, when we talk about...
Less meat-based, less sugary.
But Italian food... Everyone praises Italian food. French food, everyone praises French food. German food...
Well, it's not known, is it, for... You think currywurst?
I think schnitzel. Mm. Any advances on that?
Mm-hmm. Gingerbread?
Oh, maybe that's all right. Well, you think Christmassy, don't you?
Yeah,
you think
Christmassy.
Beer, isn't it beer you're meant to think about?
Yeah, you do.
Beer, you shouted into
the mic. Shouting.
Yeah. Not a food.
Not a food.
Not a food.
liquid lunch,
however
surely.
However much you might want it to be.
I get all my calories from you.
And the third piece in that triptych...
is a wonderful piece by Nikki Segnett, who B. Wilson was on the show talking about.
She was.
Nikki Segnett's book not that long ago and enthusing about it. And Nikki Segnett has written a review of Daunt have just reissued Consider the Oyster, which is one of M.F.K. Fisher's most famous books.
It sounds amazing, this book.
And Nikki Segnett opens with this wonderful anecdote, this beautiful anecdote, which I'm going to quote for you in full. The oyster lady at our wedding reception might have been an unusually dedicated reenactor from a Dickens festival. Plastered on arrival, she nabbed a bottle of champagne and drank with Mrs. Gamp-like determination through the speeches and first dance. Her oysters came seasoned with blood and shell fragments. A friend asked if he could have one without the crunchy bits. No, she barked, and went back to mutilating her thumb with a shucking knife.
Oh.
It was a talking point, at least. But oysters are like that. Some produce pearls, others stories. And so that's her entrance into this collection of essays by M.F.K. Fisher, which you're a fan of, Lucy.
I love M.F.K.
Do you remember in Dwight Garner's commonplace book, Grace Jones's Rider had 24 oysters, and the quote on it was, Grace shucks her own oysters.
Oh, yes.
So what a dude.
Yeah. I introduced my daughter to oysters for the first time 2 weeks ago, and she loved it.
Brilliant. Because she didn't think, she didn't have any preconceptions.
No, I just think, I had like the shallot and vinegar thing and then the Tabasco.
So the usual Sunday around your household, 24 fin de clair.
This is a day oyster.
It's a day oyster. So we had it with
this
day
is a
champagne.
Oyster.
I don't want to.
Later on.
I didn't want to introduce her to a night oyster.
No. She's too young.
No, I got. Well, we were at a place that had it and she was kind of interested. I thought, we'll have it. And then. And she liked it. My kids quite like seafood. They like seafood more than I do, but she sort of went for it. And
there are because now she won't be frightened of them.
No, there's nothing really to be frightened of. Do people still... except if you have a bad one, put you off for life.
But I think people are put off by the ritual, aren't they? They don't know how to do it and they think it's alive and it's gross.
But I think if you have a bad one, you're more disposed to have another bad one in... Or you're more disposed to have a reaction. Yeah,
is that just self-fulfilling prophecies?
Really?
No, I think there is a thing that once you have a bad reaction to an oyster, you're the chance of you having another bad reaction to
oyster, like wasps and bee stings.
It increases. And so
is that true?
It might,
I don't know. I've never heard that.
I've had it put to me, but I mean, we could have to ask Nikki Segnett. You have to do that via email.
Okay,
so I'll report back on my new world theory of wine value, and can you please report back on, is there a danger in oysters?
You're pitching a Notes and Queries podcast series to the company for
you. Yeah, exactly.
Tune in later to find out.
Any answers?
Yeah, we are.
It's basically just like fact-checking ourselves, but with a delay.
But we haven't done it.
Yeah.
It's a bit like not preparing properly, Roz, for this type of podcast.
It's like post-publication fact-checking.
Yeah,
exactly. It's a dangerous game.
Yeah, do it beforehand. Any more for any more there, Thea? Because we also have...
We also have Catherine Morris on the pub, the casual profundity of a proper British pub.
Brilliant.
Why do we prize them? Why should we mourn their loss? She's reviewing a book.
Pubs at all. I don't really like pubs.
I spent quite a lot of time with Catherine Morris in pubs.
You guys, I think TLS people generally, they're quite pub-going people.
We had I don't know why you're looking so blank, Michael.
Yeah.
Yeah, you are looking as though butter wouldn't melt in your mouth, Michael, which is absolutely misleading.
TLS journalists, you know, it's quite rare for journalists these days or any employees to go off and have a pint at lunchtime, but that still happens, doesn't it, at the TLS?
Yes.
No, we're too busy working. I think Michael
does. I don't do the lunchtime.
But there was a pub in our old offices, a wonderful pub called the Calthorpe, which Catherine particularly loved.
This makes Catherine seem... Let's be absolutely clear.
I mean, we were there with her. She didn't go
on her
own.
One of the most diligent people I've ever met in any walk of life.
Yes.
Works incredibly hard. And there's a pub. Kaz was there all the time.
No, she just loved it for what it was.
We all loved it.
As we all did.
Other thing about that area is it was a journalist's part of town, wasn't it? And the pubs had different assigned tribes of journalists.
Yes.
There was the Politico's pub, there was the Cartoonist's pub where they'd sit quietly and mutter about people.
And
this particular pub was
across the road from the Welsh Society.
The Welsh Men's Choir.
Yeah, so Roz and I were there once, and this whole group of Welshmen came in and just erupted into
the barmaid's birthday. We didn't realise they were all together and they were all part of the Welsh National Choir. We just thought the pub was full. And then one of them found out it was the barmaid's birthday and he said, "All together, lads," and the Welsh National Choir sang "Happy Birthday to you" in a very small pub.
It was divine.
And it was absolutely transformational. It was good.
Yeah.
The character was magic. Maybe a bit showing off, but they had something
in
to show
close
off.
In tight harmony, were they singing Happy Birthday?
It was a bit like that symphony, I think.
It was too believy. The thing I remember about the Calthorpe is
Welsh
that
for believy.
They had quite a lot of mice and stuff, and you think, all right, that's fine, it's old school. And then they had it was refurbished. Remember when it was refurbished and they had new carpets and everything, but they kept the mice.
Did it have a meat
raffle? Which I thought was good.
It didn't have a meat raffle.
It had some dodgy chips, though. Yeah. It had really nice
chips. We had chips all the time.
Yeah, chips, no. Meat raffle, I think, is a sign of
I don't really know what a meat raffle is.
You've never been in a pub with... You're northern. No. How have you not... Surely it's part of your birthright
meat.
To know about meat
luxury.
Raffle.
No, I don't know what you're talking
about. So
what
they do is... The idea was in pubs that they bring out a platter of raw meat and you can win it.
Is this something you've dreamt of?
No, it's not. Thea, can you...
Yeah, no, it was a thing. The pub I'm thinking of in Leeds, which was near the meat market, was... I think the meat raffle was mostly run by people who had stolen the meat from the market, though, so it was a whole other level of grime.
Was it like prime cuts of meat or not so much?
I mean, not the ones I'm thinking of.
Do you want to email someone after the...
Everyone's going to have a job. Yeah. A Leeds butcher.
Can you email anyone with butchery knowledge and find out if that's true, or Thea and I have sort of separately.
It's just the pubs that we
go
to.
If you say so.
Maybe that's why you don't like pubs, Steve.
Yeah, it is. I don't like pubs. Just go to a pub without
a meat raffle.
It said, if you have a bad reaction to the meat raffle.
I've heard that. I'm not sure
that's true.
Someone needs to check that as well. Now, before we go, we were going to... Ella Baron, Lucy.
Yes.
Our lovely cartoonist.
Yes.
Very good cartoonist. And she did, about a few weeks ago, she did Literary Love Island, which was a homage to Love Island, the terrible TV show, and using literary examples of people getting together.
Mm.
And for Christmas, she's done Literary Bake Off. It's a brilliant idea, which is examples of literary food.
It is, and it's a brilliant idea.
And it's got, that I can remember, which again we should have researched slightly more carefully before having this conversation, Lucy, but we're going to proceed anyway. Miss Havisham's Wedding Cake.
Yep.
Proust's Madeleines.
Yes.
Rebecca's Crumpets. Which sounds like a euphemism,
it does,
but isn't.
But crumpets or muffins. Crumpets, I say.
Muffins, no better.
Muffin, no, it's all
it's
bad,
got
isn't it?
Something Dickensian, hasn't it?
Miss Havisham.
Oh, yeah. Thanks.
You're thinking of Ian Sansom's piece, maybe, which has the scene of the food throw.
Yes, it does.
This is a good link because I was thinking one of my favourite things in reading books is when they describe food. And we talked to Laura Freeman, the writer, about this because she wrote a book about how food helped her with anorexia and it gave her an appetite back. And she's going to write a piece
food
for us
books.
about post-Second World War rationing led to writers being hungry or hunger being in the air. And so it's full of novels with hunger and sort of enjoying food because they're kind of having to get it only in their imagination. So I thought we could talk about any times in books, not arts.
Books we've read.
Books we've actually read.
Though not necessarily foods that we have eaten.
No. Favourite literary meals or drinks?
I've got one.
Go on.
I've had this for a long time. I didn't have to think for even a second. I mean, there are others I could work up.
Yeah, but you haven't.
No, but I've I've got the quote and everything.
But you haven't worked up the others.
I have worked up the others.
Oh, fine.
If you would like me to talk about them, but the one that I really remember that always stuck with me is the pie in Danny the Champion of the World.
Yeah.
So I think it's when do you remember when he drives the car? He has to drive the car on his own. He's 10 or 11 or something, is he? And he has to drive the car and go and try and get his dad out of the trap because his dad has fallen into the poacher's trap and he's broken his leg, I think. And Danny has to get him out and he has to drive the car there on his own and come back. And then I think his dad falls asleep or something. And the neighbour or the local doctor brings him round a pie and then he tells you about the pie and it's the most amazing thing. And I realise now that I'm fulfilling my northern stereotype because it is about a pie.
Yeah, but you've got some credit because you didn't know about meat raffles.
So. Okay, yeah, no, so I'm very, very posh. I've got the thing here if you want. Do you want me to read about
it? How long
about
is it?
The pie? It's quite long.
Go on,
are you worried you'll be bored?
No.
Okay, he says, so he's from the doctor, and he says, I saw before me the most enormous and beautiful pie in the world. It was covered all over, top, sides and bottom, with rich golden pastry. I took a knife from beside the sink and cut out a wedge. I started to eat it in my fingers, standing up. It was a cold meat pie. The meat was pink and tender, with no fat or gristle in it, and there were hard-boiled eggs buried like treasures in several different places. The taste was absolutely fabulous. When I had finished the first slide, I cut another and ate that too. God bless Dr. Spencer, I thought.
Magnificent. And actually, if you think about Roald Dahl book, I think the chocolate in the first time Charlie Bucket eats the chocolate, the golden, creamy, he's so hungry, and then he eats the chocolate and wolfs it down. Boggis in Boggis Bunsen Bean, Fantastic Mr. Fox, is that him? Where he has the donuts filled with goose fat.
Oh, yes, but that's gross. But
bird pie.
Yeah,
stuff in their beard. Yeah. Beard.
There's obviously something around him, and he was a product
of... And Matilda and the cake, the boy who has to eat all the cake.
Mm. Oh, the fat boy who makes all the chocolate
Bruce
cake.
Bogtrotter.
Bruce.
Yeah.
So, I mean, he's in this period, this
post-war... He is.
This is that period, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, but this
hunger.
Is a nice one.
Yeah.
It's the eggs that do it for me.
Yeah, like treasures.
What's
like
better than an egg in a pie?
We've got to be quick, so everyone has a quick one if they want to. Roz, you don't have to because you weren't aware that
I've thought
it was
of one.
Go on.
It's a Believe-y book.
Like all the best.
I don't know why I thought this one, but it is a good one. The Heart of the Matter by Graham Greene starts with a character waiting for a gin-based drink. He's on a balcony, he's waiting for a gin-based drink. And it's a brilliant way to start a book. Because when you're waiting for a drink, you take in your surroundings and you fill the person that you're with, you fill them in on what's happened.
Yeah.
And between the moment that we realise he's ordered a drink and he's waiting and the moment he gets a drink, everything is set. It's brilliant. And then he gets a drink and
he tastes the
it,
drink. Yeah.
And it's hot. The weather's hot. The drink's cold. And it's just really spot on.
I was thinking of drink in The Sun Also Rises, Hemingway. They go fishing. This is before the fiesta starts. It's full of drink, this novel, if anyone's ever read Sun Also Rises. They drink so much it's almost unbelievable. But they go fishing at one point. It's a very hot day. They have bottles of wine they've brought with them. And as they go fishing, they find a spring, a pipe, and they take the bottle of wine, drive the cork down and put the wine down into the spring and then they retrieve it and it numbs their arm as they put their arm, and then when they get the wine and drink it, it's ice cold and it tastes faintly of rust. And I've always imagined what that would be like. It's a good drink-based one, I think.
That's a fantastic one. I like that. I'll tell you what, there's an eccentric one, which therefore not everyone's going to agree with. This is Iris Murdoch in a novel, The Sea, The Sea. She's a very eccentric protagonist in this, the theatre director, who retires, goes somewhere remote, and he starts thinking about this sort of first love. And in the middle of it all, there's a weirdly comic part where she starts. This is quite typical of her. I really want to do a book called The Iris Murdoch Cookbook because she's so eccentric about food. But see what you think of this. So he's always got opinions about food, this character. I ate 3 oranges at 11 o'clock this morning. Oranges should be eaten in solitude and as a treat when one is feeling hungry. They are too messy and overwhelming to form part of an ordinary meal. I should say here that I am not a breakfast eater, though I respect those who are. And he goes on in that style, and then he brings you up to lunchtime. The orange feast did not dim my appetite for lunch. which consisted of fish cakes with hot Indian pickle and a salad of grated carrots, radishes, watercress and bean shoots. I went through a period of grated carrot with everything, but recovered. And then he has a long disquisition about ice cream. He's completely mad. And then he just goes back to talking about his first love.
Brilliant. But he's going to tell you what he had for lunch.
You can recover from a grated
carrot. I'm
better now.
I think fish cake with hot Indian pickle.
Sounds lovely.
Sounds nice. A bit of grated carrot to cool it down.
It sounds to me like she herself made up a lot of meals that just whatever was in the cupboard, and they get into the books as well. So it's quite fun looking for food in the books novels.
Go on, Thea, we should finish with you because you are the food queen.
Okay, well, I'll be quick then because, well, Virginia Woolf, the obvious one. There's To the Lighthouse, where she's got the Buffon d'Aube, which is just becomes this vehicle for all sorts of anxieties about life and death and social anxieties as well, because, of course, Mrs. Ramsay isn't the one who's going to cook this magisterial meal. Marta's going to do it. And so you get two pages of description. The exquisite scent of olives and oil and juice rose from the great brown dish as Marta, with a little flourish, took the cover off. And then she goes on and on and on for, two pages. Then there's A Room of One's Own, where we meet the soles, which are so served to the Oxbridge men, which are sunk in a deep dish over which the college cook has spread a counterpane of the whitest cream, save that it was branded here and there with brown spots like the spots on the flanks of a doe. And that's contrasted with the kind of watery soup that the women have to eat.
Quite right.
So, you know, that's just a way of kind of carrying her whole argument. And then you've got James Salter, who just wrote beautifully about food. Well, if you think of Light Years, that book there, I think that begins with about 20 pages describing the meal being put together by the central couple in that novel. And everything is just perfect. And it's building. But of course, it's all just performance. So food is performance. The mealtime is as a kind of these coded messages. And you slowly become aware that the relationship's afraid and it's all a ruse or a show.
Last one,
R.C. Sharif, Journey's End. Because it's not something that people really think about in terms of the food.
No.
And yet food is sort of centre stage there. It kind of borrowed from the English Renaissance tradition of having a table as a prop. So think Macbeth and Banquo's the Feast.
Yeah.
And the table is literally dressed as though it were an actor in its own right. And these men in the dugout. So it was released in 1928, but it was set in 1918 in Saint-Quentin in the dugout there. And food and the kind of the interactions between the men is just so fraught. And it's the unravelling of civilization as they know it. And it ends with them having sandwiches because that's just way easier than the rest of it.
Nothing wrong with sandwiches.
New world order.
Yeah. Isn't that always the way?
Do you have the grated carrot?
No mention of grated carrot. Plenty of dubious tinned things and mystery meats.
Can I have some more cake?
Yes.
Yes.
You're going to finish now, Ross, so you have time to have some cake. What's the cake called again?
Dolce Varese.
Lovely. And it's nice.
Delicious.
That's all we've got time for this week. Our thanks go to Michael Caines, Lucy Dallas and Ros Dineen. Now eating cake. Make sure you've bought at least one subscription to the TLS as a festive gift this year. I'll be checking. We'll take a break for the festivities, but we are producing a cash-in Bone Idol Best of the Podcast in 2018, so listen out for that. Until then, from Thea, me and everybody at the TLS, have a very happy Christmas and a suitably literary new year.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.